After teaching biology for a few years and earning my master's degree in natural resources, I changed directions and began a 35-year career with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. The interview leading to that job was conducted by two people. One was the man vacating the position for which I was interviewing, and the other, Bill, would be my supervisor if the interview went well. Although nervous, I was also confident because I'd done my homework about the job and about the organization and was ready for anything they threw at me during the interview, or so I thought. What I wasn't prepared for was Bill. Now, let me preface this by saying that Bill turned out to be one of the best supervisors I've ever had in any job. He was fair, intelligent, and principled. He motivated people by example, and his door and mind were always open. Once you sold him on an idea or proposal, even if it defied the prevailing political or departmental authority, you couldn't have found a stronger advocate, sometimes putting his own job on the line in the process. Bill was all these things and more, but he was also the very definition of unorthodox. His language was usually laced with profanity. His honesty and straightforwardness often came without tact, so he could be offensive. But you never had to guess where you stood with Bill, because he was blunt, like a sledgehammer. Now, back to the interview. I'd cruise through all of the softball questions. Tell us about yourself. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I felt like I was doing really well with the heavier questions. The interview was winding down, and at this point, I was feeling pretty comfortable. Then came the sledgehammer that I wasn't expecting. "You seem like a pretty calm, mild-mannered person," Bill said. "What pisses you off?" Well, like a deer at night blinded by headlights, I froze. Several thoughts raced through my mind in those seconds that seemed much longer. None of them related to how I would respond. Instead, I was trying to figure out his motive in asking the question. Was he serious or kidding? Did he really want to know the answer, or was he just testing me to see if I would try to evade the question? "Apathy," I said. "People need to take a stand. Even if I disagree with their position, it makes me angry to see people who are apathetic and just don't care." Well, the expression on Bill's face was somewhere between a smirk and a smile. The interview was over, and I left not knowing if that final question had sealed the deal or if they were back at the office calling other candidates. Upon arriving home, the phone was ringing as I walked in the door. I had the job. Now, that last question probably had little or nothing to do with their decision to hire me, but the fact that my aversion to apathy was the first thing to enter my mind at that critical moment indicated the depth of my concern about people with no concern. For the most part, my feeling about apathy hasn't changed. When it comes to important issues, people should take a stand. And even if their stance is far from mine, if it is well-reasoned and studied, I can respect them far more than people who just don't care enough to consider the matter. But is apathy always a negative? Are there situations when apathy might be the appropriate and even the most logical approach? Well, today I'm going to spend a little time discussing the nature of apathy and its potential impacts, both negative and positive, then move into the relevance of apathy in theology and the attitude of apatheism. There was an article in the November 2021 issue of Psychology Today by Dr. Christine Baccio, who is professor of psychology at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. Dr. Baccio talked about the dangerous effects of persistent apathy that can lead to low energy, lack of motivation, and impaired daily functioning. She said that apathy can also be contagious, influencing others who are not highly committed to a goal to become indifferent. A number of studies have indicated that apathy is often an early indication of Alzheimer's. The impact of apathy on society is pretty obvious. In 2020, just under 67% of eligible voters exercised that right in the national election. That means that one-third of eligible voters didn't bother. And that percentage of people who did vote on the highest voter turnout in 120 years. Yet, only two-thirds of the people voted. The average voter turnout for presidential elections since 1980 has been about 10% lower than that, and turnout for elections in non-presidential years is dismal, averaging only about 50%. Consider how apathy is affecting what is arguably the most devastating crisis in human history, climate change. In Leo Barassi's book, The Climate Majority, Apathy and Action in an Age of Nationalism, the author says that climate deniers aren't the main roadblock to resolving this crisis, but rather public apathy. The billions of people who have heard plenty about climate change and acknowledge there's a problem, but who are just not engaged enough to stimulate the change required to stop it. And who among us has never turned to apathy when a problem is more than 5,000 miles away on the other side of the earth? Out of sight, out of mind. But the pain and the suffering continue whether we choose to see it or not. It's not hard to find and recognize the negative aspects of apathy. As one anonymous quote puts it, apathy is the glove into which evil slips its hand. But surprisingly, research suggests that apathy is not inevitably counterproductive. It can yield positive results. In the Psychology Today article I cited earlier, Dr. Baccio refers to selective indifference or selective apathy, saying that it can help redirect emotional resources to meaningful concerns. In other words, good apathy allows us to focus our energy on what matters most. It protects us from being emotionally drained by matters that don't allow for constructive responses, freeing us from unhealthy anxiety or unhappiness. Selective apathy allows us to apply our time and energy to the more significant concerns and relationships in our lives. Best-selling author Josh Kaufman puts it another way. He says that every day you are bombarded by things about which other people think you should care. It's like a fire hose of information asking you to pay attention, change your mind, change your plans, to care about what they care about. Imagine for a moment what it would be like to open the gates of your mind and emotions completely, to care about everything that comes your way, eliminating the option not to care. It would simply be overwhelming. In order to function in a world overflowing with information and options, we're forced to filter. The easiest filters are usually proximity and status. Is it close to me? Will this benefit me? If so, pay attention. If not, filter it out. The name of that filter is apathy, and we all use it every day in the service of sanity. Better to invest yourself in things you can change or control. Choosing not to think or worry about things you can't influence or control is apathy, but it's strategic apathy. So how does all of this tie in with religion and theology? Well, at the intersection of apathy and theology is an attitude that's been termed apatheism. Dr. Robert Nash, professor of in the College of Education and Social Services at the University of Vermont, first coined the term in 2001, but the idea has been around much longer than that. One of the first recorded apatheists was Dene Diderot, a prominent figure of 18th century France during the Age of Enlightenment. Diderot wrote, "It's very important not to mistake hemlock for parsley. But to believe or not believe in God is not important at all." Of course, Diderot's views were not well received by the Catholic Church or the government of France, and some of his work was banned by both. But Diderot's observation formed the basis of how some might choose to approach a question that has baffled humanity for centuries, leading to personal anxiety and even holy wars. An apatheist is someone who is not interested in accepting or rejecting claims about the existence of gods because the question is simply considered irrelevant. Now, this position should not be considered synonymous with skepticism. An apatheist might maintain a belief in a god or may not, as I'll touch upon later. So how might one arrive at the decision to take an apatheistic approach? Contemporary philosopher Dr. Trevor Hedberg begins by explaining that debates in philosophy of religion almost always focus on questions about God's existence. Does God exist? Is it rational to believe God exists? Can we know whether or not God exists? He calls these questions, logically enough, existence questions. While there is little doubt that philosophers regard existence questions as significant, do these questions really warrant the level of importance they're given? An apatheist would say no. As Dr. Hedberg goes on to say, you can be either an atheist or a theist and still be indifferent about the general questions. You might believe in God. You might even be religious in some sense. But you might think, at the end of the day, if I came to think God didn't exist, it really wouldn't have that big of an impact on my life. You might not do things differently. You might even still keep going to church because you might see the value there in the community, practices, and religious rituals, even if, metaphysically speaking, you don't buy everything. Even if you're a committed non-believer, you could say, well, even if God turned out that God does exist and I got the question wrong, it really doesn't matter. Jonathan Rauch, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, points out that apatheism is not concerned with what you believe, but rather how. Apatheism is an attitude, not a belief system. So the approach might be adopted by people across the spectrum from theist to atheist. Even regular churchgoers can and often do rank high on the apatheism scale. There are a lot of reasons to attend religious services, as we UUs can certainly attest, to connect with a culture or a community, to socialize, to expose children to religion, or to find the warming comfort of familiar ritual. This concept of apatheism being concerned with how you believe rather than what you believe was explored in depth by University of Wisconsin professor of political science, Dr. Adam Scott Kunz. Kunz observes that standard discussions of God revolve around the degree of one's belief. Do you believe in God is often seen as the fundamental question in any discussion of religion. Response to this question will range along a one-dimensional spectrum, with agnosticism at the origin and forms of atheism on one end and theism on the other. Whereas atheism and theism take polar opposite positions on this question, no versus yes, agnosticism denies that such knowledge is available at this time. Instead of viewing apatheism as a different form of belief, Kunz maintains that apatheism and zeal can interact with atheism and theism on a two-dimensional spectrum. Just as atheism and theism arrive at opposite conclusions concerning their convictions about a deity, apatheism and zeal arrive at opposite conclusions regarding attitude about the existence question. These two dimensions, when combined, offer a very helpful rubric for understanding how claims of conviction and attitudes intersect with one another when a person discusses belief in deity. A person can be a theist while at the same time having an attitude of apatheism or zeal toward existence questions. Likewise, an atheist can be either apatheistic or zealous. Now, zealotry likely needs no explanation. You can only see the latest news stories about sectarian conflicts somewhere in the world to get a sense of what zealotry is. Apatheism is equally forceful in its indifference to questions about deity. Knowing where an individual lies on this rubric would be very helpful before engaging in discussions of existence questions, or whether those discussions would even be welcome or considered an irrelevant waste of time. In summary, we return to where we started, with apathy. Regardless of whether he or she believes in a deity, the attitude of an apatheist about questions of God's existence is apathy. They have determined their values and developed a moral compass to help direct them to live according to those values, just as we have done with the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. None of those principles address the existence or non-existence of a deity, but they help us navigate on a high road toward leaving our world and humanity in a better place. An apatheist would say, why waste time debating existence questions? That time should be better spent on questions that can be answered or issues over which we have some control. If conclusive proof about the existence or non-existence of a God were to suddenly be revealed, it simply wouldn't matter. An apatheistic approach to problems and issues over which we have control is negative and can be devastating. But strategic apathy related to unanswerable questions can result in freeing us to put more time and energy toward the things that impact our world. American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr is credited with the Serenity Prayer, something I suspect you've all heard. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Another way of looking at this comes from an old soil conservationist that I knew, Tom Pugh. When he felt like too much time was being spent debating a question that was beyond our capability of answering, he'd say, it's time we fish or cut bait. An apatheist has come to the conclusion that when it comes to questions that can't be answered, the logical course of action is to cut bait.